everybody, and welcome to another episode of Horror Movie Night. Unfortunately, this week we are not joined by our regular third co-host, Brian, but in a, I would say an upgrade, we've got Becca and Dave McKendry, who you know from the internet, as well as various other films and projects. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey!
Internetly known.
Internetly known. I love it.
I've known Becca and Dave for fucking years from being San Diego Comic-Con neighbors.
Almost, I'd say 8-9 years now, or actually even longer, because we started doing San Diego Comic-Con while we still lived in New York City. It'd be like close to a decade now, because the Fangoria booth, Dave and I worked for Fangoria for like 13 years that we were with Fangoria, and we always had the booth directly next to you guys at Comic-Con, and so we've known each other forever.
Yeah, and then you guys have advanced to, you know, working with Blumhouse and doing all these podcasts and making movies, and I'm still at the Geekscape booth every year at San Diego Comic-Con.
It's okay. It's a good place to be.
Wait, who is this again? Who are we talking about?
So, Geekscape is a good place to be. And hopefully we'll see you guys at Comic-Con this year. I don't think we'll be at a booth, but
we'll be wandering around
with our kids, yelling at them. So you'll see us then.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, if you have some DVDs that you want to sell at Comic-Con, I think I know a booth that will have you for an hour or two.
Oh, that could be fun. Right. We'll just show up and hang out and let you go. We'll just leave the kids and they can sell them and we'll go off
no,
and
wait,
get
do we
some
get,
drinks.
Do we get guest passes with that? Are we industry? What are we going to be? What kind of backstage access?
You get a Sunday visitor pass. That's all you get.
Sunday. Oh. You get a kid one day.
All right, so we're going to talk about one of the most disgusting films that's ever been released.
Awesome.
I have to interject here. I picked this with every time I pick a Yuzna film, well, up until this time, I was like, hey, Matt, do you think that we can get Becca on or what? Because like, I know that you, the gooier, the better when it comes to, I mean, I'm not into the nunsploitation, but I'm definitely into the gooiness.
No, for some reason, gore has always kind of been my thing. And it's weird because I'm also very picky about my gore. But this is kind of like my jam. And so I love this movie so much.
And it's weird because the gore is not like the gooey, street trashy, multicolored stuff, but it's like flesh.
Yeah, and I mean,
that's what makes it worse. Better and worse.
And Dave loves street trash. That's definitely one of your favorite movies.
I like the whole splatterpunk movement that just came out of that the late 80s.
Yeah, there was definitely some good stuff from that time period.
Can you explain your love in like a very short essay for street trash? Because I've watched it like what, 2.5 times for this podcast and hated it every time.
Oh my God.
It's just so exploitative. So you tell me why you love it.
Well, you just summed it up right there. It's so exploitative. I mean, it's brilliantly shot. You have the Steadicam operator who since then has worked for
Spielberg.
He's Spielberg's camera operator now. And the way it's shot is just so magnificent and beautiful with these Steadicam shots that are amazing. And add to that the Technicolor gore, the ridiculous storyline, and just the...
Well, the effects, too.
The
effects were done by Jennifer... I can't remember her last name. But she had just come off of a couple trauma movies, and she's gone on to do some amazing stuff. And we actually, Dave and I, worked with her when we did a show for The Nerdist called Blood and Guts.
And apparently she still has the toilet one.
The toilet monster from Street Trash is in her garage. Yeah.
That's a good place for it.
Yeah. So she owns a restaurant in Los Angeles now called Cecina.
Yeah. And I know that at one point, I love this movie so much. I actually toyed around with the idea of making a staged musical out of it. This is back when Reanimator was like hitting the stage. Had a musical adaptation. I thought this could really be a neat little musical adaptation.
We still find it fascinating. No, it was right after we saw Evil Dead, and then we'd seen Evil Dead on Broadway, and then we had just moved to Los Angeles, and Graham Skipper is a friend of ours in our new movie, and we went to see him in Reanimator, And Dave and I were just shooting kind of the shit about it. Mm-hmm. We were like, if we could turn any movies into musicals, what would it be? And we decided on Street Trash and Howard the Duck.
Yes.
Sums up our taste right there. We were like, there is a brilliant Howard the Duck musical that exists. And we actually came up with some of the songs for Street Trash. We should
and
really,
Howard the Duck. We came up with a few.
We had Cleveland.
Because really, we're trying to EGOT, I think. If you want to do. We're covering all the bases. We're going to go into musical theater. And I think Howard the Duck will get us the Tony.
I think so. Well, Dave, we come from a musical theater background, musical theater and experimental theater, which is a really weird place to be. But that's actually how we met, was doing both of them simultaneously through our theater program.
Right. We were both working on Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard.
Yeah, we were in Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard, but a really weird, minimalistic version of Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard.
And then we, at the same time, we're also working on Funny Thing Happened on
the Way to the Forum. So. And that's how we met. And so then we discovered that we were both like huge horror fans and exploitation movie fans. Mm-hmm. And here we are like 20 years later.
Yeah. But going a little bit back to Street Trash, the other thing I really love about it is it's a time capsule of New York City during a certain period that when we were living in New York, it was the Disney Times Square era and everything had been cleaned up. But that late 80s, early 90s grit.
Like a basket case. Basket case catches that really well too.
Yeah, any of Abel Ferreira's stuff.
Yeah, but like, was it really that grimy, or was that, you know?
Street Trash definitely amps it up. I mean, Street Trash is more of like a caricature. There was no like, you know, throwing penises and things like that.
My great grandparents were living in Brooklyn during this time period, and when we went to visit them, we'd always get the "Don't go into the city. Don't go to Manhattan. It's crazy there. You'll get killed." Yeah, this is the late 80s, and it was still pretty dark and gritty place.
You know, and I do have to say, the few times that I've we lived near Abel Ferreira when Dave and I lived in New York. We lived in New York for a number of years while we were working for Fangoria. And I interviewed Abel Ferreira, and one of my questions was...
You always say number when you can't remember.
I know. When I interviewed Abel Ferreira and Bill Lustig, actually, as well, talking about the films of that time period, and Frank Henenlotter, one of my questions was always like, is it as bad as it looks in your films? Because like in Abel Ferreira's Driller Killer, he's showing just people just vomiting on the streets and then just keep walking and they're just vomiting.
And they weren't really people living on the streets.
Yeah, and they all told me, you know, it was pretty freaking bad. So I don't think it was quite Street Trash grade bad, but I'd say that, you know, Street Trash was definitely trying to mirror real life and then amp it up a bit.
But I don't think there were too many like Tolkien-esque societies living in the junkyards there. With, like,
that's true. It is really Tolkien-esque. Right.
You have
we
like
just really elevated Street Trash here.
There's a medieval society.
You heard it first.
It's like the Game of Thrones in New York City.
It is. You
underground
have a king
homeless
that they appease and are afraid of that runs the whole place. There is that whole breakdown of feudal society.
Wow, man.
So it is
got
the most
heavy.
Genius movie of our time.
Yeah, we're going to turn it into a musical. That said, it's really bleak. Like Street Trash, even though it is Technicolor and it's clearly being shot like a comedy, it is a bleak film. There is very little redeeming about that aside from this kind of forlorn love.
And none of the characters are going to rise out of their position. And you kind of know it from the beginning.
So we're here to talk about society. And
they are the opposite end of the spectrum.
They really are. But yet they feel like the same film. Street Trash and Society, they definitely are the opposite ends of the socioeconomic spectrum. But at the same time, it still has that kind of body mortification. The idea of feeding off somebody and even the idea of exploiting the lower class is still really prevalent in both of them. So, yeah.
Well, it's funny because when you guys mentioned writing a musical, I got so lost for a second that I thought you were talking about a musical on Society, which I think Society would be an amazing musical well, honestly.
Oh, I love that.
Pretty much any. Dave and I would totally write a musical on any of that.
I will write a musical right now.
Off air, let's rap about that because that should happen. Not the Street Trash one.
Well, and also, how would you stage that shunting? on stage.
Oh my God. I would go kabuki theater with like strips of fabric.
Yes.
I was just about to say kabuki theater and like shit like that. Absolutely. So society kicks off with a credit that I don't think I've ever seen in a movie before, which is surrealistic makeup effects by
Screaming Mad George.
Mad George, yeah.
Yeah, who we love, who now teaches, he teaches at a film school in Tokyo.
Yeah, and I could see him giving himself that title. He's more artist than
I mean, like he definitely did movie effects, but I mean, when you look at his stuff, you see it's so much more dolly than anything else. Like it's a work of art. Mm-hmm. And they even
how he approached it too.
Yeah.
As he was creating art out of these bodies.
And I mean, they're almost, when you look at kind of the final orgy scene, I mean, it's got mirror images of each other. It's clearly, he is trying to create an almost kind of panoramic view of everything. And he went to say that, you know, he was definitely looking at a lot of Dolly's works when he did mm-hmm. this, and it totally makes sense.
I wish I could, I should have done a little bit more research, but there was a quote he mentioned about like a Dali-esque horror that he was trying to do. Like,
there's a painting called The Great Masturbator. That's the one.
Thank you. How did I forget The Great Masturbator?
I know. Right?
Yeah, it was the other name for street trash.
High school nickname. Or
but yeah, Screaming Mad George. I mean, he did a couple of Usna ones. And I mean, the Usna film, the other one that has just these crazy effects, which I believe were by him, is really hard to find. The Necronomicon Book of the Dead one with Jeffrey.
Yes, it's so good.
So good. Dave and I have the VHS copy, but I don't know if it's been released to anybody
the
else.
Only way that I can watch it is I got the the VHS PS rip of it. That's just the VHS tape on a DVD. But mm-hmm. yeah, it's so gooey and good. Like it's really, really good.
No, and the Usna segment in it is by far the best one, because that's where it's got like people's heads flipping open, and that is the one with Jeffrey Combs. I think that's the Usna one. But
the one with Jeffrey Combs, wraparound. It's one that I've wanted to discuss on the podcast many times, but we kind of have moved towards a no anthologies rule just because it's so hard to stay on topic. But Necronomicon will break the rule for some time because it's just so, so good. And it doesn't have like a modern release, but I watched it on YouTube, which is at least enough for me to talk about it, you know?
And speaking of anthology films...
Hey guys, we just made it anthology.
Well, you guys said you don't talk about anthology. So.
Well, I think that we would also make an exception because, you know, the people behind it are on the air right now. Okay, so then tell us about your film, because it's been almost a year since you finished it, right? And it's coming out.
We finished it. We finished it in the summer we were still shooting in March of last year on the coldest night in history.
Right.
And in Los Angeles, like you never think that Los Angeles dips below freezing. And it did on the night that we were shooting the parking lot segment. It was freezing.
And as it was a Christmas movie, it wasn't one of those things where once we're done at the summer that we could just release it at Christmas.
Yeah, we finished.
We kind of missed that cutoff.
Yeah, like we wrapped in March, and I think we had a final cut done by and everything. Like we had everything done by June, and then it was like, now let's wait for 6 months for Christmas to roll around.
Right.
But hey, it's releasing now, and All the Creatures We're Stirring. It is a Christmas horror anthology, and we're in Redbox now. And we go to DVD, Walmart, and all the VOD platforms, iTunes, Amazon, stuff like that, on December 4th. We go to Shudder on December 13th, and then we do our big Blu-ray release in January. So,
And it's
fantastic.
Yeah. You'll see a lot of kind of horror regular folks in there just because we have worked so much in the horror community for the past several decades.
And it really was. It was a love letter to everything we enjoy in horror.
Yeah.
All the styles that we wanted to take on, the people we wanted to work with. It was just, you know, it's weird, but, you know.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun.
It was what we wanted to do. We wanted to take some styles that we'd grown up with, like Italian Giallo.
Yeah, we do a Giallo segment. We wanted to do something that was kind of a love letter to the Twilight Zone.
The Joe Dante films of the 80s.
Yeah. Okay, now I'm really excited.
Well, and I think I emailed Becca when this happened, but I went to with my friend to see Crazy Rich Asians, and I was like, why is Constance Yu look so familiar? And then I look on her IMDb page and I went, oh, fuck.
She's in our movie, which was awesome.
She was great to work with.
She was great.
Well, in that scene that she was in. And
going in, because it is a horror comedy, Dave and I knew we wanted to cast a lot of sitcom actors. So we went with like Jonathan Kite, who at the time was on Two Broke Girls. Amanda Fuller, who is still on Last Man Standing, the Tim Allen sitcom.
And she's also in Orange is the New Black.
Yeah, and Constance Wu. And so, yeah, we knew we wanted to go with more comedic actors. And even when we were doing our casting within the horror people, we looked for people who we knew had a lot of comedic chops, like Grant Skipper and Jesse Merlin and Chase Williamson.
Matthew Mercer.
Yeah, we specifically sought out people that we knew could really carry a comedic tone as well.
Well, go and check that out. It should be on iTunes and stuff like that by now, because it'll be coming to Shudder in a couple days.
Two things I really have to say that just like I don't want to steamroll through. We don't have to talk about him, but I just really want to point out that cheerleader Shauna, the girlfriend, is in Slumber Party Massacre 2, which is one of my top five favorite horror movies ever, and Friday the 13th Part 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then
my favorite Friday the 13th. People will argue with me to the end of time over that one.
But
as soon as shit gets telekinetic, I'm like there.
I back away from all Friday.
But the other thing I wanted to say is that this movie is so gross, not because of the gooiness, but rather the audio. Like, this movie grosses me out just with the audio, and I don't think I know any other movie that can do that.
The audio is a plot point in it, too, because it starts with videotape of his parents, like, weird and then it gets erased, and then somebody's like, oh no, it's real. And so the audio becomes a plot point. So I'm sure that Usna was like, hey guys, this needs to be really, really, because it's kind of what kickstarts everything. Like, he catches a glimpse of his sister doing some twisty moves in the shower, but
oh, the back boobs,
the majority of the plot line, kind of our MacGuffin, is built out of that audio tape. So I'm sure that Usna was like, this has to sound like fucking amazing. And it does. And then at the end, it just gets so gooey. It sounds like silly putty being rubbed together.
Well, that's like one of my notes I wrote down was, I was like, the first hour of this movie is good, but the last 30 minutes is just a masterpiece. Like, you can't look away from it when the shunt begins to happen. Before that, though, the one thing that I definitely wanted to bring up is the scene at the beach. Because there's a lot of things that happen in that beach that drew attention to me. First of all, kudos to those children, because that is an incredible amount of sunscreen that they were able to spray onto that girl's face.
Oh my God, so much sunscreen in the face.
That's very Freudian. That scene's very Freudian.
The giant monster intimidates him at the end of that scene.
Clarissa's mom, who looks like she just wandered off of a John Waters set.
Yes,
in the
exactly.
When I first saw it, I thought that was divine for a second.
Yeah, like, she feels so out of place in this movie. Every time she shows up, I'm like, I could do without this character. She really brings nothing to it except for coughing up a hairball at one point.
Well, and Dave, as we were revisiting it, Dave was like, oh my God, there are so many 80s Playboy models.
Oh yeah, it's late. It's that late 80s thongs and Playboy models movies.
Yeah.
Is that your thing, though? Like, is the thong over the hips? Like,
it goes
up to the underarms.
Well, you love those like Andy Sedaris movies.
Oh my God, yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of
like the long butt thong.
The long butt,
back when long butts were in style, and that's I think one of them was a Playboy model too. The
really?
Evil girl, the
girlfriend,
the rival to the girlfriend was a Playboy model.
That would explain her acting abilities. Yeah.
It's that Kelly Bundy era of television.
So much
and
hair.
Film.
And then even having a character that's obsessed with hair is just, you know, kind of par for the course on this one. But yes, so much hair.
So when I was reading up on the movie this morning before we recorded, like, there's a lot of elements that were last second editions, like everything with the therapist, which I mm-hmm. find really interesting because that's so kind of key to the rest of the plot for that to be like a last second edition.
It really does become kind of the Greek chorus of everything, where it's because it's always hard to find a way to get your characters to get out, you know, their emotions, kind mm-hmm. of their inner emotions, without having them just say it to somebody. So the inclusion of the therapist is actually like a really smart way to do it. And it really does offer a nice framing device.
It ties all the scenes together.
It does.
As it needs to be. It's kind of a wraparound for them.
Yeah, it does. It feels very wraparoundy.
Like you said, it ties the movie together and it actually provides some like really weird scene. Like the opening scene is so strange with him like biting into an apple and it's filled with worms and like, to think that none of that would have been there, like the mm-hmm. like the, it just would have started with the credits and gone right into like this guy's perfect life.
Yeah, the thing I liked the most about that was when he returns to the therapist's office, he bites an apple, and you get this like obvious look of, oh, good, no worms. It's just such a blatant delivery of that.
Yeah.
I would have been really gun shy about eating an apple from that guy's office if, like, I ever got a bug in it. I don't know. Yeah,
the first one's rotten. You just don't take from that same bowl when you go back.
He puts the apple back in the bowl after he took a bite of it.
Really?
Yeah, he does. I remember that. For some reason, I remember he bites the apple and goes, oh, good, no worms. Then he turns his, like, the doctor says something that makes him go, oh, there might be worms in this. And he puts it back in the bowl.
It's like the worst double dip ever.
He said so much without saying a word.
Wow. Yeah. How many?
Do you know there are offices that have fresh fruit in them?
Probably not.
I've never really gone to somebody's office.
Well,
like
it's
that.
Beverly Hills. Maybe they all have apples.
So therapeutic apples.
Therapeutic apples.
I think that was an Asian pear, though.
Oh, it could have been.
It looked like Asian
brown.
Pear.
We love Asian pears. Brown. That's my go-to delicious. Fruit of choice.
That would be a Beverly Hills fruit.
Hey, Becca, I made a delicious Bosque pear tart for Thanksgiving. So, I mean, if that's up your alley, you might want to look into making one of those next time you have
Bosque
to pick something.
Bosque pear. I think we have some of those in the kitchen right now. Yeah. Yeah. That sounds very artistic, though, Bosque.
Hey, Matt, leave that in.
Nice.
So, the other thing that kind of struck me as so weird in this movie is any sequence with the school debates, because that was something that like my school didn't really have.
Yeah, we had full debate.
We had a debate team, but they didn't go in front of the school and debate.
That's what I mean. Like debate team, I get, but like when you're running for class president, having like multiple debates before like your election, quote unquote.
We had campaign speeches. I
like,
remember
they went up there, they yeah. said something, they were usually running unopposed because I had like 100 people in my class, and that's what we had.
Yeah, but I think that this one, the movie really tries to play up the political angle because it is so much about kind of the society and the upper crusty and the idea of politics and things like that. So the idea that he was like a shoo-in for class president and seems to be on the up and up until he stops feeling it. I think that they really went out of their way to show that, you know, that he was really fighting for something before just out of nowhere he suddenly goes, I don't feel this anymore.
I did love how the dweeb candidate had such a heavy campaign manager. Like, just that thug campaign manager he had.
Yeah.
That was great.
That makes sense. I didn't even think about that, but that all ties back into the like, hey, I've got an internship in Washington and like all of the like this is kind of the training ground for an actual political run to get the society even higher up.
Yeah, no, I think that what they're trying to show is that these aliens are probably already really ingrained in politics mm-hmm. and are already kind of running the country and feeding off the poor.
Well, yeah, they have the judge that is one of them.
Yeah, like they're going out of their way to show that, you know, these people run the world and that it is, they're just, you know, kind of keeping control of everything. Mm-hmm.
I hate to be that guy, but they're not aliens. They said so.
They're not aliens?
They're not aliens.
I'd always thought they were aliens.
They literally say, we are not aliens. This was my first time watching the movie start to finish. I've seen all the iconic scenes, but I've never watched it from start to finish. And that blew me away. That's the only reason it stuck in my head is because they, at the end, he goes, you alien scum or something like that. And they're like, no, we're not aliens. We're just like you, but better or something like that. I can't remember the exact line, but literally they are humans. They're just a different kind of human that likes to eat slugs and shunt.
Been here.
So they're like more of an evolved human.
Yeah, okay. Well, because the rich have always sucked off low case shit like us.
Yeah, and this movie comes in kind of at the tail end of that die yuppie scum attitude.
Conspicuous consumption, yeah.
Yeah, because we had the '80s and the excess of the '80s with the yuppies, the die yuppie scum movement, and then we get this at right at the tail end.
Well, I mean, there's many reasons that this movie may not have done as well in the U.S. as I would like for it to have, but I think the fact that they held it for a couple of years probably didn't help that, because it was 1989 was like the peak of like 80s culture, die yuppie scum, and if you look at everything else that was coming out this year, it was that year 1989. It was very sad. Akron stuff like Look Who's Talking and Parenthood and stuff like
that. The rise of the rom-com.
Yeah. Then to have this, and they ended up holding this for a while until 1992.
Yeah.
And it went through X ratings and problems with release and things like that. And so then by the time it finally did come out in 92, I think a lot of the kind of 80s, you know, kind of Gordon Gekko, it had the edge had been taken off. It was still there, but it was not at quite the same fervor that it was in 89. And so that combined with the fact that there is a shunting scene kind of damaged the movie a bit.
Yeah. And you also have, we just ended, you know, the Bush presidency. We're going into the Clinton 90s. This isn't a movie that
screams Clinton 90s. Yeah.
This isn't the grunge era movie.
Yeah. But that said, it did really well in Europe. And what's weird is one of my best friends, Elric Kane, who I co-host Shockwaves with, whereas with me, this was like a video store find. Like I stumbled on this in a video store when I was in high school and was like, what the hell's this? I've never even heard of it. And it was just always kind of an underground cult hit for me that, you know, you didn't watch with your parents around. Elric remembers a completely different reception for it in New Zealand, where like it played theaters, it ran on television, it was like film. It was like a major film release. So it's just kind of like differences of the culture and how it's, you know, was playing there. So Elric and I have talked about that on the show many times, about how for us it was quickly buried and still has had spotty release history, as opposed to it's a major movie that everyone loves. We all know society.
I probably wouldn't have seen this if I hadn't have worked at a video store at the time.
Yeah.
I saw it come in. Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. I remember seeing the cover all the time at the video store, and it didn't look like anything that was really grabbing my attention, because I was like, I don't know, I had to be like 13 or 14 walking around a mom and pop's video store, and I was looking for more Full Moon pictures and more slasher films. So this kind of went under the radar. And then college comes around, and now I really want to see it, and I can't find it anywhere. And I felt like I really missed the opportunity in the VHS days. And I didn't see it until I had to buy like a bootleg of it at like Monster Mania in Cherry Hill. That was the only way I could find it for the longest time.
Yeah, that's why I hadn't seen it until like the whole thing, until specifically watching it for the show, because I worked at a video store in high school and we didn't have a copy of it.
No, I definitely found this at like our mom and pop video store in my little tiny Virginia hometown.
The one I worked for was like a mom and pop shack. They got it in.
Yeah, this wasn't at the Blockbusters for sure.
They had shit like Little Witches, but they didn't have a society.
I'd rather enjoy Little Witches, but that's another show.
I mean, we can talk about that some other time, but son of a bitch. It was like 10 minutes ago. I was like, oh, I have a comment that I wanted to say, but we got off topic. Maybe
Howard the Duck musical.
Yeah, we did an episode, a bonus episode on Howard the Duck a couple months ago. And have you watched that recently?
Yeah.
I have not. All I remember
it's not watchable.
I remember the songs because she actually sang in it. They did that. They call him Howard the Duck. And I remember her name. The name of their band was Cherry Bomb.
Yeah.
But that's about all I got.
I remember that, and that the villain actor got arrested.
Yeah, but we always liked the comics. So we were kind of like, you know what? We'll base more off the comic than the actual movie.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. Thank you so much for mentioning comics. So I know – well, Dave, did you work on Hellraiser with Becca?
I did.
You guys do that together? Okay.
We co-wrote that.
Okay.
Both of them.
All right, so my all-time favorite.
Scott, do we lose you?
We're never going to know what his all-time favorite is.
Oh, my God, his all-time favorite is back now.
Wait, I'm right here.
Oh, there he is.
Okay, we need closure.
Oh my God, Scott, what is your all-time favorite?
So my all-time favorite is Swamp Thing, Alan Moore.
Nice. That is, I have not read that comic, but both Elric and Ryan, who I co-host with, are huge fans of that.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, they both say it's amazing.
I will say that that movie grossed me out for like one
thing. Which one? Return or the original?
The original. There is a part where somebody bleeds white. And for some reason, I found that to be the grossest thing I'd ever seen in a movie.
Plant.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I know he's a plant, but it was just weird that this like white milky stuff
was
coming out.
Have you ever like?
It's disgusting.
If you pick a daffodil, it's all like
yeah, there's
white.
Goo in it.
Yeah, I know, but for some reason that disgusted me more than anything I've ever seen in any other movie.
Street trash, totally fine.
Yeah.
Society, fine. Oh my God, he's bleeding white.
White stuff. Bleeding white is just gross.
The Hellblazer, like I think it was is it Warren Ellis that did Hellblazer originally, the Constantine Hellblazer stuff? Was that Warren Ellis or Garth Ennis?
I am not sure on that one.
I can't remember the name of the story, but I think it was a self-contained issue or two, and it was about this couple that were the conspicuous consumption 1980s yuppie types, but they're actually demons, and it was like Keeping Up with the Joneses, but there are all different demons that were trying to keep up with each other in society and stuff. It just seemed like a very interesting tangent to ask if either of you had read it, and if you haven't, it's really good. I'm sure it's in some collection. I have it in some graphic novel collection, I'm sure.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
It might be only two issues or something like that. It might be one issue, but it was a really fun kind of inversion of that whole conspicuous consumption thing that society really talks about. And it's very funny that it was shelved for 3 years because, yeah, by 92, no one gave a shit. Everybody cared about grunge.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah, that was like the we were starting to get into grunge at that point. It was like the death of the hair metal.
And there were so many movies in the 80s that fit into society's category, just even like Wall Street and Bright Lights, Big City. These are all things that
less than zero.
Yeah.
And
there was like a whole movement of these movies that talk about the excess of society that this movie would have fit in great with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like Billy's sleepaway camp level booty shorts in the beginning of this movie.
I mean, that was like, you know, predecessing Baywatch.
Yeah. Our shorts had gotten a lot longer.
Yeah. That they did cast such like a hunky guy for that role, but yet he's still very kind of befuddled and everything.
And mulleted.
Yes. Very mulleted.
Ooh, yes.
Let's talk about the best part of this movie. Let's talk about our favorite moments from the shunt. What are your, because there's so much. It's just 20 minutes.
How can you even pick?
Insanity.
I mean, I got to go with the pulling his head through his ass.
Yeah.
Legendary.
See, I like when the different heads start coming out, because then you get the sister and everything, and it's just so weird.
Oh, that's the big
iconic. The mom with the hands for feet and the sister between her legs is just insanity to me.
Is that considered the shunt scene, or is that a separate shunt, or is it shunting when they rip somebody inside out, or is it whenever they connect?
The second that people start taking off their clothes until the credits roll.
Yeah, that's pretty much, I mean, that's what I think most people, I think that technically shunting in general would be the moment that they go kind of up the guy's posterior and pull him out the backside. I think is kind of the quintessential moment that most people think of it as. But that said, I think that we could just, you know, it's the last 20 minutes of the movie.
Yeah. And I do love that random hand that rubs Milo, the sexy cop, you know, like his buddy who comes in with like the, oh, I heard that someone needs to get arrested. And then he puts on, he like hits his boombox and starts stripping. But some random hand from the shunt just like rubs his face and he smacks it away.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like Looney Tunes-esque things that happen in the shunt that I love.
But it's still so depraved. Like, this is the most depraved shit. And it's so good.
One of my favorite, and I don't even know why I love this moment, but there's a moment where a woman's mouth is attached to a guy's chest and she starts pulling away and it actually starts like the mouth starts twisting. And for some reason, I really like the effects on that one particular shot. It's just like a super long mouth. And I really just love the effects there that they did with it.
I reminds me of that scene from Who Framed Roger Rabbit when he goes up to the building and he sees that car, the back side of this woman. He's like, oh, she's beautiful. Turns around, it's give me a kiss, love.
Yeah.
And the mouth sticks out.
Yeah.
That's what is it, Kinder Trauma? Is that what?
Kinder Trauma, definitely.
That's the term you guys use.
I'm a big fan of the head towards the very end with the eye, with the fingers coming out of the eyeballs and the mouth hole before the pole inside out.
Because it's like the inside of a bowling ball almost.
Yeah.
Well, I really wanted to see the party end. Like, how do they all come back into their forms and they just make sure that you have all your parts?
They just walk away the next day. I also enjoy how kind of gooey it is, that it's not just flesh. I mean, because if you look at your skin, unless you haven't showered for a very long time, skin is not shiny like that. Yeah. But in this scene, it looks like they've coated every single person in like olive oil.
Oh, it's a natural.
Yeah. Like, it's very sweaty. There's like this lubricant going on with all of them. And so it doesn't even feel like normal skin. It just feels very gooey. It ups the ante on the goo.
I will say that with all the incredible special effects in this movie, it really makes the butthead seem very lackluster by comparison.
Oh, yeah.
It does. And that's what they always put on the cover for some reason. And it's
a spoiler, funny. Though.
Yeah, it's funny, it's amusing, but it's not like my favorite scene.
I'm wondering if screaming wasn't like off stage with some kind of hose.
Just to hosing constantly them down.
Spray down the shunt. So
you know, that wasn't olive oil, that's fucking KY.
Oh,
a big barrel of KY. Intense.
Oh. You know, there's a movie that just came out. It is, South American horror. I want to say like Argentinian, called Terrified. It's running on Shudder right now. But there's a lot of kind of body horror effects in that, that as I was watching it, I was like, wow, that was Yuzna-ish. Just because it does kind of have that body morphing stuff going on in it.
Oh,
highly recommend it. It was really good.
Yeah, I didn't get to see it because it was playing at Fantastic Fest at the exact same time as You Might Be the Killer, and that was way more up my alley. Was a hyper meta slasher film that is we just had the director on recently. It's amazing. So if you haven't seen it, Becca, let me set you up for this because this is kind of right up your alley. Premise of the movie is a dude wakes up covered in blood at his summer camp and realizes that all of his counselors are dead, but he can't remember what happened, and he's trying to remember if he was the person that killed everybody.
Ooh, okay, yeah, I'm in. That is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. Dave and I both, we love anything that sets up a mystery, which is, it's kind of my love of a subgenre that doesn't exist that I say it exists, which is five people in a room, how the hell did they get there, and who's going to die, subgenre.
There's so many movies that fit that plot.
We don't know what to call it, and so I always... and it's the shove five people in a room. How did they get there? Why are they there? And how are they getting out before everybody dies?
Connected.
And yeah, and we love those movies. I think we've seen most of them.
Yeah.
And so yeah, anytime that it sets up kind of a mystery of why everybody's there, what's going on, or who's going to die, or anything like that. And that sounds almost like a After Hours. Is that the one where he wakes up and doesn't remember anything?
No.
What's the one I'm thinking of? It happened one night? No. I'm just naming titles now.
There is a
movie that you and I used to watch where a guy wakes up and can't remember the night and he's retracing his steps through the city. Well, anyway, this is a movie that we watched together. So, and neither of us can remember it. Why are we even talking about it? Oh, God.
Well, Becca, I've got a name for that genre you're looking for, and I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to steal it right from the Twilight Zone, but the genre should be called Five Characters in Search of an Exit after the Twilight Zone episode of the same name.
Yeah, and I do have to say, like, if we really want to go back, I'd say that Boonwell...
Five Characters in Search of an Author?
No, I was going to say Boonwell's Exiting Angel, or Exterminating Angel, which is, it's no exit. I mean, it's definitely no exit, but yeah, I mean, we could go no exit, but Boonwell did the five characters trapped in a room they can't get out, but he made it very upper crusty.
We'll call it very Sartre-esque.
Yeah, very Sartre-esque. So, yeah.
Would you consider Cube to be in that?
Definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. I consider that to be kind of one of the most well-known ones.
Well, even the Saw films have
Exam.
A
yeah,
I was thinking Saw, yeah.
Exam's a really good one. The Killing Room.
Would you rather?
Yeah, I didn't enjoy that as much as I wanted to.
No,
same with Circle was another one where... the premise and the setup and how it's people in a room and they discover that if they move out of the circle, they immediately get electrocuted and they don't know how it's working or why. And, you know, kind of uncovering it. I was so into that movie until the very end. And then I was like, okay, it's exactly what you think it is.
Yeah, I just did it better.
But yeah, that's kind of, we love those movies and one day we will write one. Yeah, yeah. But they're not very popular right now. We've pitched a few and everybody's like, meh. Well, one room, there's a big rise of them
in the late 2000s.
Because that's when the budgets in Hollywood really started plummeting. Kind of when the VOD market started to rise and the DVD market crashed. All of a sudden in the late aughts, you suddenly see this like a hustle to get movies made for like a couple $100,000. And so your biggest expenses are cast and location. So let's shove five people in a room and see what we can make it, you know, work. And you can still get production value a little bit, but have it, you know, made for $300,000. And so there was a huge boom of those during that time, especially post Saw, the kind of mind game movies, but there haven't been any lately and no one wants them.
All right. Well, everyone has to go see Escape Room then when it comes out.
Yes. Oh my God. Now that one is not going to be like that because apparently that, shifts, there's giant effects in it. It's not a $300,000 movie. It looks awesome though.
But we'll all go see it. It'll make a lot of money, and then you and Dave can try to resell your five people in a search of
exactly.
This is what we do. We look out for.
Is there anything else anyone wants to add about society before we wrap it up?
Is that what we're talking about?
I do have to say, I have the Arrow video release in front of me of Society, like the big fancy box set that they did, and it's awesome, and has a really cool comic book with it.
Ooh.
Called Society Party Animal. And also, I was really bummed that there was never a sequel to this. Usna actually had one keyed up, Society to Body Modification, that he was looking at doing during the 90s. And I wish that it happened, and I really want to read the script.
You know what probably killed that? Strangeland.
Really? Oh, yeah, I guess so a little bit. Yeah, the DC.
I was just joking, but I mean, it's because that movie, like, they hyped that shit so hard.
Oh my God, yeah, no, that was it. It's like all about the body modification and everything and the infamous lip sewing scene. But yeah, that was, I wonder if that did it. I have no idea what was supposed to go into that. But I wish if the script exists on the internet, someone please find me and find it and connect us.
Ah, yeah. The smell of the video store. I love this place.
Do you remember when you could just look at the walls of covers?
We had to choose just by looking at the cover and reading the crappy synopsis.
It was, you were leaving with one.
And the only way to know what new movies were coming out is you actually had to watch the trailers instead of skipping them.
Right, we didn't have the internet to look it up. We had one guy named Todd behind the counter that would tell us what was good or not.
And Todd strangely liked way too many romantic comedies.
Yes, but you always knew when the boobies were coming because Todd made sure.
Oh, and remember all the awful CG we had to put up with in the mid-90s?
We talk about that a lot, don't we?
Join us on Analog Jones and the Temple of Film, where we talk about VHS tapes.
And we wax nostalgia like none other.
All right, then what is everybody's Society double feature? For Becca and Dave, if you're not familiar with this element of our show, we pick a movie that would be a lovely second feature to watch if you were having a nice night inside. I'll kick it off with The Blob from 1988. I feel like this would be really good.
Yeah.
Nice.
Like, you watch The Shunt, and then you're like, I want to see more of that, and you pop in The Blob remake.
I'm honestly, there's two that I would say. I would say Get Out or The Purge because of the socioeconomical elements of it. But then it does have that tone to it, that kind of, you know, it's clearly a political statement. But purely on kind of a fun paranoia level, I would say the Abel Ferreira Body Snatchers remake.
Mm. Ooh, is that the one from the 90s or the 70s?
The 90s. Yeah,
is that one actually worth watching?
It's good. It's actually pretty decent. I don't mind. Yeah, that's the one. I don't mind it. The 70s is great, but I think in this one.
That's a review you want to read.
I don't mind it.
I actually
see that on Shockwaves a lot, and it means that it actually kind of holds its own. Yeah, it does not piss me off. No, I enjoy it. So that was the Abel Ferreira one from the 90s. But I mean, the 70s one is definitely the superior film. But I think to match with kind of the tone of this one and the time period that it's set in, I think that the 90s one would be my go-to.
Well, I think we've already mentioned the one I would go to, Street Trash Society, just to get that little yuppie New York vibe.
That would be a rough 3 hours, all right? That's a lot to stomach all at
that
once.
That is a lot.
Or even Basket Case.
Basket Case might not be bad because that does have kind of the body horror element.
One or two.
Two. I was going to say Basket
Two,
Case.
Because two is a little bit more.
Actually, I take it all back. I would go the one with Elmer.
Brain Damage. They're both horror comedies. It would feel a little bit lighter.
And they have the social commentary because Brain Damage is about drug addiction.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, totally.
All right,
well,
Scott.
I mean, I'm not interesting at all. I'm just going to go with the other gooeyest movie I can think of, which is Silent Night, Deadly Night 4, Initiation, which I wanted Becca to come on. I wanted Becca to come on for that when we discussed it for Christmas in July, but it didn't work out. But again.
Wait, the Brain Bear is 3. I need to rewatch.
The witches, the coven, and bugs and Clint Howard and...
Pretty much anything with Clint Howard in it, I'm going to watch, which brings me to another
He lives near us, but
yeah, he does.
I've seen him around town.
But that brings me to one of my favorite Clint Howard gooey films, Ticks, which if you guys have listened to...
Yes!
So good.
I heard Ticks fan.
About the dangers of marijuana.
The dangers of marijuana.
You could do Ticks and Brain Damage as your drug PSA double feature.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
With a little Liquid Sky for a triple feature?
We're not. Okay, listen. No.
A triple? Okay.
I love Liquid Sky.
I know. That's why I've listened enough to you guys talk about it. I don't want to watch Liquid Sky.
It's weird. It's not a pleasant film. There's something that I find really intriguing about it. I want to go back to when they were filming it and be like, now tell me about the chicken scene. I just don't get it. The scene where they chant that they're chickens. And then they turn it into a song.
I still want to know if they're taking performance artists seriously or mocking
them. Dave and I have had this discussion. We can't tell if it's making fun or trying to enhance it.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting place to be.
Movement.
Are they trying to make a statement or become part of it? And I don't know.
Yeah, it feels like a combination of both. My music box or my sound box.
Yeah, my rhythm box.
Rhythm box.
My rhythm box. It doesn't box. Yeah. There's so much of it that we're like, oh, this is definitely part of the really performative art crowd.
Yeah.
But then it feels like it's mocking it. So who knows? It's wonderful.
All right. Well, one last time, where can people go and check out all the creatures we're stirring before we completely wrap up the episode?
So you can find information about all the creatures we're stirring on our Facebook page, on our Twitter. We're being put out by RLJ Entertainment, so you can definitely find them as well. We are in Redbox right now. We will be on VOD platforms, Amazon, iTunes, all that grand stuff on December 4th. We hit Shudder December 13th, and then we do Blu-ray sometime in January.
Yep.
And you can find Dave and I on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all the same stuff. And you can listen to both of our respected podcasts. I co-host Shockwaves and Dave.
I co-host and co-host, I guess.
Yeah.
How do I say that? Fear Initiative, which is also on the Blumhouse Podcast Network.
Mm-hmm.
Do a quick explanation of Fear Initiative for listeners who don't know what it is, because I think that since it's a little bit outside of what Horror Movie Night does, It's cool to get an explanation from the host.
Yeah, so I've been playing Dungeons & Dragons since middle school, and it's been I've enjoyed it and loved it for many years. And I got inspiration from a lot of the D&D podcasts that were out there, where we sit around, we play Dungeons & Dragons. I'm the Dungeon Master, and I don't know if I can go more than that.
It's all horror themed.
It is horror themed.
It's like horror Dungeons & Dragons.
Right.
Yeah, it's very focused.
It's a horror adventure zone, basically.
Yeah,
it focuses on monsters, scary setups, and you create a lot of the storylines because they don't really exist in any of the books or manuals or
so
anything.
So yeah, the storyline is completely created. It's group storytelling. So it's kind of, it's created by all of us, all the members and all the players. And it's made up as we go, some of it. We've invented some monsters that are more fitting with the horror community. I know we have a monster that is the thing oriented.
Yeah, you've done. And Dave will actually pull from movies where he'll be like, how can I put a Freddy Krueger-esque creature into this? Yeah. So it becomes kind of like a dream demon and things like that. So it pulls a lot from horror movies.
Yeah. And you can also hear me do terrible accents because I am not a voiceover artist in any capacity.
But you're a good DM from what
I do my best to DM.
Anything that convinces more people to play D&D is a good thing to me. So
I agree. I really do. I want to. It's so therapeutic. It's fun. It brings a lot of people together. And I think it has so many good uses that I'd love to see more people play it.
Well, and I think a lot of people are afraid of it. And I do want to say real quick while you're talking about it that for me, I think my fondest D&D memories, the game is always like the least memorable part.
Yeah.
It's like being with a bunch of people and just having fun and laughing and inside jokes and all of the things that kind of stem from taking on another personality for sometimes 14, 15 hours if you're only playing once a month with a big group. But
oh yeah. And it's a great way for people to meet each other. Cause on our show, we brought together some people who had never played before, people who had never worked with before. And we are all like great friends now after going on these adventures together.
Yeah, a couple of them are in our movie as well, yep. Like Megan Duffy, Morgan Peter Brown. Actually, Jeff Seidman, who is on Fear Initiative, edited our movie. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it was just a really tight crew.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, we'll go download those podcasts if you haven't already. And thank you once again for joining us. We were talking about Society from 1989, as picked by Scott. Thank you again to Becca and David for joining us. And we will be back next week with another episode.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.